Shalom from the Rabbi's Son, and welcome to our introduction to Parsha number 29, Akari Mot. Our readings for this week will begin in Leviticus chapter 16, verses 1 through chapter 18, verse 30. Our Haftarah readings come from Amos chapter 9, verses 7 through 15. And the Brit Chadashah readings for this Parsha will come from 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verses 9 through 17. Our theme for this Parsha will be that atonement will be made for you, Leviticus 16, verse 30. It is a new week, the week of Parsha number 29, Akari Mot. The Hebrew phrase means after death. In this Parsha, the ultimate extreme bridal makeover protocol continues with a slight twist. In this Parsha, we discover that our bridegroom king's call to become holy as I am holy requires us to die to everything in and around us that is not holy, and to simultaneously let him teach us to abide in and live unto him who is holy. Holiness cannot happen for us without the death and burial of our flesh. Our will must die. Our curiosity about the dark realm and the perverse pleasures with which it pitches its wares must die. Our insecurity must die. Our rage must die. Our offenses must die. Our desire to criticize, complain, accuse, and judge must die. Our craving for a city, tower, and a name for ourselves must die. Our thirst for influence, control, and for seeing and enjoying the impact we have on others must die. Our opinions and philosophies and ideologies must die. Being holy, we will discover, means saying with the Master and meaning with all our hearts, "Not my will, but yours be done, Father." Most of us have heard the English term atonement used extensively in religious contexts. We inherently sense that atonement belongs on the required doctrines list of our framework of systematic theology. We understand that it is important, but we don't know why. Do we have a meaningful grasp of exactly what this thing we call atonement means to our relationship with our divine bridegroom? Do we understand what atonement means in the context of a covenant? Do we have a functional understanding of what part atonement plays in the ultimate divine makeover protocol that constitutes the essence of the book of Leviticus? Most of Christendom has a hazy mental picture of atonement as the experience of being acquitted of what we think of as our sin by the great judge of heaven, or at least pardoned to the point that we are ultimately not held accountable for that sin. But the atonement concept about which we read in the Torah is not a concept of English jurisprudence. Indeed, the English language does not even exist when the Bible was written. Our English word atonement is therefore a very rough approximation of what the ancient Hebrew word underlying it means. The essence of the action Torah describes as kafar, and which English-speaking students of the Bible know as atonement, it is covenantal. Outside of the context of a living, vibrant, growing covenant relationship, the imagery of atonement makes no sense whatsoever. What needs kafaring, you see, has its root and essence in covenant. What needs kafaring is not a moral failing or an antisocial behavior pattern. It is a breach of covenant. If there has been no breach or perceived breach of covenantal protocol, there is no need for and nothing to be accomplished by kafar or atonement. Immorality is not the issue kafaring is designed to address. Social welfare is not what makes kafaring necessary. The issue involved is relational, not moral or social. Kafaring is all about restoration of covenant relationship. But if we are parties to a covenant, it is understood that from time to time we, and indeed everything associated with our lives, is going to very much need this thing we know of as atonement. Atonement is not a theological concept we are supposed to believe in with our minds. It is instead a substantive covenant reality that someone in the role of a priest has to assah, to make and build and construct. For us, through painstakingly physical activity performed on our behalf. So let me get more specific. The first usage of the Hebrew verb kafar in Torah is found very clearly in Genesis chapter 6. More specifically, in chapter 6, verse 14. the Holy One tells Noah that in preparation for the flood which he is soon to send on the earth, he wants Noah to make yourself an ark of gopher wood and make rooms in the ark and kafar it inside and outside with kafir, to cover it inside and outside with pitch. Gesenius opines that the Hebrew verb kafar literally means to cover or to overspread or to cover over. But let us look deeply into what kind of covering we are talking about. Noah was to make an ark out of etzei gafar, in other words, gopher wood. Note the similarity of the Hebrew word gafar, describing the wood to be used in building the ark, to the Hebrew word kafar, about which we are speaking. The only difference is the first letter. Gafar is spelled gimel, fe, resh. Kafar is spelled kaf, fe, resh. Gafar is believed to mean oozing. Gafar wood is believed to be resinous wood that oozes sap when cut, and therefore seals itself off against moisture. It was going to take many pieces of gopher wood to make an ark as big as Noah was instructed to build. And however good a carpenter Noah might be, there were bound to turn out to be seams and cracks and gaps between the pieces of wood he used. Seams and cracks and gaps are definitely not good for watercraft, or for those who use watercraft for their mode of deliverance. While oozing sap from the planks might help seal the cracks somewhat, in order to fully make the vessel waterproof and impenetrable by raging floodwaters, the Holy One instructed Noah to do something very important to protect those destined to be delivered through the ark. He directed Noah to kafar both the inside and outside of the ark with kafir. Our English Bibles chose to translate kafir as pitch to make sense to English readers, but the exact substance with which the inside and outside of the ark were to be overspread is not specified. Nowhere else in Scripture is kafir translated as pitch. It is usually translated to mean ransom or redemption price, or appeasement or restoration compensation. So, if what Noah was to coat the ark inside and out with was not really pitch, then what was it? Whatever it was had to be something that would compensate for the inevitable cracks and seams in the wood. Wherever the best efforts of Noah to build an ark would prove insufficient to accomplish salvation and deliverance for his family, the Holy One provided in his word for something to be added to cover every deficiency and make up every lack. Welcome to the substance of what atonement is all about. The Hebrew word our English Bibles translate as atonement is kafar. Let's put aside our preconceived Western notions of what atonement is for a little while and explore the revelation inherent in that Hebrew word, shall we? As we have discussed many times in the course of these studies, each Hebrew letter is a hieroglyphic word, picture, or pictograph. Since words are combinations of letters in sequence that makes every Hebrew word a hieroglyphic mural, a pictograph in motion, keeping that principle in mind, let us look at the pictograph created by the letters of the Hebrew word kafar and see what images present themselves to our eyes. The first letter of the word kafar is a kof, which provides the K sound. Pictures a winged creature with its wings cupped in flight but descending, covering and casting a shadow on the place it is about to land. The second letter, a pei, which in this case provides the F sound, pictures a mouth or lips representing an opening or portal. The third letter, a resh, which provides the R sound, presents a picture that is interpreted two ways depending upon the context. One common interpretation is that it pictures a man's head, figuratively the head of a household, or the head of man, the Holy One, or his Messiah. Another common interpretation of resh is that it pictures a sinner, in Hebrew called a rasha, a man who has wandered from the household. In the case of the word kafar, the dual imagery presented by the resh means that a mural is being presented that shows something happening simultaneously in two realms. On the one hand, the winged creature or the seraphim are flying around the Holy One's throne and are reaching toward the Holy One's mouth to receive his words and his breath. That is what is happening in the spiritual realm of heaven. But also simultaneously, because they have upper and lower sets of wings, The seraphim are also alighting upon and reaching towards the lips of the Rasha, the covenant breaker. Does the image I have just described strike a familiar chord yet? It is what Yeshayahu, Isaiah, saw in Isaiah chapter 6. The seraphim that surround the throne of the Holy One, receiving his words, simultaneously they are placing a burning coal from his eternal flame upon the mouth of a man of Tame lips. This was necessary in order that the king and the sinful man might commune together, and that the sinful man might be placed back on the path and foundation established for him in proper relationship with the king. So now you see what atonement means Hebraically. Now you should be able to understand why the Ark of the Covenant, a model of the throne room of the Holy One in heaven, had to be constructed having two winged creatures on its kafar, on its cover. May the Holy One grant you to experience it in all its fullness, and may your life and mine forever mirror and reproduce the kafar mural. Akari Mot begins with a cryptic reminder of the recent deaths of Nadav and Avihu. Among the multitudes who participated in the Great Exodus, these two sons of Aaron were the first to die. They represent the first fruits of death in the camp of the redeemed. In order that an unthinkable strange fire event like that, which led to the deaths of Nadav and Avihu, not occur, however, the Holy One follows up his reference to their demise by laying out a pathway of holy fire. The road markers along this pathway of holy fire are his essential protocols of atonement, the Kedusha, the Avodah of Yom Kippur. The Holy One begins by turning the eyes of Moshe and all the readers of Torah to a great day he has established. The 10th day of the 7th month is set aside by the Holy One forever and all our generations for a very special theme and purpose. That day is not to be like any other day of the year. It is the holiest of days. It is on this day that the Holy One will reveal and release the atonement he has ordained for mankind from before the foundation of the world. This is to be set aside forever as the great day of kafaring. This special day of our Bridegroom King is the appointed time for breaches of covenant by the nation and each person in it where they are to be dealt with. The day has a name, Yom Kippur. It means the day of complete covering. This day will join Passover and the associated Feast of Unleavened Bread as the first to be revealed of what will eventually be seven annual Moedim, divine appointments between the Creator and His people, each of which is designed for very specific covenant reaffirming purposes. The holy protocol for Yom Kippur has several facets. First, the date must be discerned. Secondly, on this very special day, the high priest is to put on special garments of pure white. Thirdly, the special role of the Kohen HaGadol, the high priest, the friend of the bride, on that day must be understood and appreciated. Outside the holy place, in the sight of all the people, a prophetic drama of atonement is to be acted out by the high priest. Two special kids are to be chosen from among the goats. The high priest is to cast lots, and they're to be cast to determine which of the goats is to become a surrogate of Korban Chatat, and which is to be led outside the camp and released. Fourthly, Yom Kippur is to be the day in which the high priest will actually enter the holiest chamber of the Mishkan and act out a second prophetic drama of atonement on behalf of the covenant nation. He will enter the holiest of places on the earth in the midst of a cloud of burning incense, and he will then perform an avodah, which includes confession of all breaches of covenant the entire nation has committed, and the sprinkling of the blood of the three separate korbanot on the kafar of the ark. Fifthly, the part that the individual members of the redeemed community is to play in the redemptive drama of this day is described. As the high priest is performing all these things on our behalf, we are to keep vigil with him. First of all, we are to do no regular work. And secondly, we are to deny ourselves, in other words, fast. Sixthly, the length of time for which we are to continue to observe and do our part in this special day is clearly set forth. It is to be for us an ordinance forever. Leviticus 16, verse 29. The Holy One sums it up this way. This is to be an everlasting statute for you, to make atonement for the children of Israel for all their sins once a year. Leviticus 16, verse 34. Then the focus of the Holy One in this great Kedusha discourse of Torah will turn from the prophetic drama of Yom Kippur to a number of other matters he deems critical to the holiness of the covenantal people. The Holy One will instruct us that we are to have only one altar for the entire nation. We are not to build or maintain altars for our homes, our communities, our regions, or our nations, and no korbanot are to be slaughtered or presented anywhere but at the brazen altar of the Mishkan. The Holy One will also revisit the issue of what His holy people are, out of love for Him and in order to reflect His holiness, to choose not to eat blood, as well as the flesh of animals that are injured or killed by predators, or which die by themselves by reason of age or sickness, are not to be considered food by us. In addition, the Holy One warns us that we will inevitably be exposed in the course of our time on earth to other cultures and foreign ways. That is, of course, part of His redemptive plan. He intends for us to positively affect them, not for them to negatively affect us. It is therefore essential to our mission and His exaltation that we not pollute ourselves or compromise our mission by adopting the ways of the foreigners we encounter. The Holy One then reiterates that in order to fulfill our mission, our lifestyle must be exactly what He prescribes for us in the Torah. Nothing foreign is to be added, and nothing of its holy substance is to be overlooked or subtracted. Leviticus 18, verses 4 through 5. Ever concerned about our welfare and our ability to reflect His holiness to the world, the Holy One will then set forth some very specific instructions on how to keep our eyes, minds, hearts, and other body parts unpolluted by the uncovered nakedness of anyone, or for that matter, any creature other than our heterosexual spouse. Our Divine Bridegroom will then conclude Parsha Akarimot with a revelation that it is the failure of a person to restrain sexual appetites, curiosity, and impulses more than anything which will open a person and a nation up to ever-deepening levels of perversion and will eventually culminate in blatant idolatry and the failure to value human life, even the lives of children. Any people who allow themselves to indulge unrestrained sexual appetites, he warns, winds up polluting the land he has created for his people, to the point that the land will begin to violently convulse on account of them. Leviticus 18:21, 24-30. We are to be careful not to indulge in even the attitudes, much less the behaviors, the pagans of Canaan. We are called to displace, have indulged. Now, for so many generations that the land is ready to vomit them out. Oh, beloved, we have a great calling. We have the opportunity to know and commune and co-labor with the Creator of the universe. We have the privilege of serving as the earthly ambassadors of His glorious heavenly kingdom. We were created for so much more pleasure than the fleeting and always destructive sensual experiences offered by this world could ever give us. In the Haftorah we study this week, along with the Parsha Akarimot, the Holy One our God will speak through the prophet Amos, a simple herdsman from the small village of Tekoa. The subject matter of the prophetic messages, which Amos will relate to us this week, will be what the Holy One plans to do with the national entity, the kingdom and governmental structure built on earth by the northern tribes under the leadership of Yosef's descendants of the tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh. Though he was from the southern kingdom of Yehuda, the capital of which was Jerusalem, Amos was sent to prophesy to the northern kingdom of Israel, whose capital was Samaria. Even as the northern kingdom was expanding and flourishing under Jeroboam II, the Holy One sent Amos to announce that because the leaders of the national entity had persistently for generations strayed after the ways of the heathens and had refused to make teshuvah and receive atonement and return to the ways of holiness, their days as a political entity were numbered. And the Holy One very specifically declared through Amos, "Behold, the eyes of the Holy One Elohim are upon the sinful kingdom, and I will destroy it from the face of the earth. All the sinners of my people shall die by the sword, and those who say that evil shall not overtake us or confront us." But even though the national entity claiming physical descent from Avraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov was judged, faithless, and sentenced to destruction, the Holy One promised that the covenant He made with Avraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov would not cease. He proclaimed loudly that the covenant would be renewed powerfully in the end times with a sifted remnant made up of those he would enable against all odds to survive their various exiles. Specifically, the Holy One promises, "I will sift the houses of Israel among all the nations as corn is sifted in a sieve, yet the least grain shall not fall upon the earth." In other words, the Holy One promises to take that which is perceived as evil and turn it into good. Here are some specific good things the Holy One promises to do when he brings back the remnant to the promised land. "In that day I will raise up the fallen tabernacle of David and repair its breaches. I will raise up his ruins and build it as in the days of old, so that they may possess the remnant of Edom and all the nations upon whom my name is called. Behold, the days are coming, says the Holy One, when the plowman shall overtake the reaper, and the treader of grapes the one who sows seed. The mountains shall drip sweet wine, and all the hills shall melt. And I will turn back the captivity of my people Israel. They shall rebuild the desolate cities and inhabit them. They shall plant vineyards and drink their wine, and they shall make gardens and eat their fruit. And I will plant them upon their land, and they shall never again be plucked up from their land which I have given them, says the Holy One, your God. Hasten the day, O Bridegroom of Heaven." In the Brit Chadashah passage we study this week, Shaul of Tarsus will list 10 groups of people who have chosen to refuse to receive and embrace the kingdom of God as their internal inheritance. The list of groups whose hearts Shaul says are hardened against the kingdom include those who let sexual urges control their thoughts and behavior, idolaters, adulterers, male prostitutes, practitioners of homosexual acts, thieves, covetous persons, drunkards, slanderers, and extortioners. What is the common thread between all these groups? The common link between all these groups is not merely that they are all covenant violators, but is instead that each rejected the Holy One's prescribed antidote for breaches of the covenant. In other words, substitutionary and experimental atonement. Shaul will make it clear that though these 10 groups of people tend to have especially hard hearts, there is nevertheless, as long as a person lives, still hope for every covenant violator. Because some of you but were washed and made tahor, and you were sanctified, made kadosh, and you were justified, made zedek, in the name of the Holy One Yeshua, and in the Spirit of our God. 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verses 9 through 11. That, beloved, is atonement. Bless his holy name.